From the moment that Dan White walked out of that jail, he was in control. When he made the confession, he was charging them. He was talking about corporations. He was talking about being a scapegoat. And he talked about them letting him hang out to dry. Dan White was warning the San Francisco politicians that he did a job for them, and they better leave him alone. He went up to his cell. 30 or 40 guys were just about congratulating him. He put his head back on the pillow. He had lots of visitors the first day, and he simply watched the ball games and the constant talk shows in San Francisco about Jim Jones and the Iranian students and so forth kept out of the subject of the mind control of Dan White and the fact that they described his trance-like state being a zombie and not showing any emotions for the kinds of murders that he had done. He knew right off the bat that they would give him the kind of trial that they gave in Nazi Germany and that he would be out very shortly without having to hassle with the law enforcement for these murders that they considered he was doing a favor for them. This week, the newspapers were filled out here with the story of the prosecution being weak and not prosecuting Dan White. Thereafter, Joe Freitas, they say his political career may be over because people are angry. They don't say that he should be investigated for the illegal voter frauds or the links to Jonestown and the juveniles and the welfare recipients that were sent down there. They say his political career is threatened because of the weak prosecution. But for those of you who've been taking my tapes and following the research I do out here, we've known that Freitas couldn't possibly prosecute Dan White. They allowed him to appear as Mr. Kling in San Francisco, the man in the midst of corruption. And you see, part of that is true. San Francisco politics is so corrupt. And they brought in Chief of Police Gaines from Oakland, who worked with counterintelligence with the CIA and the Pentagon, who harassed the Black Panthers and caused all the violence and killings and the prison confinement of people like Bobby Seale and Huey Newton and Eldridge Cleaver and the murders of Jonathan Jackson and George Jackson. This was very much part of the Gaines-Oakland criminal investigation group, the tax squads of Evel Younger, the California violences. Then he left Oakland, had a 2 years disappearance where he probably went to the War College and for further training because he became chief of police in San Francisco. And we have the notorious Zodiac killings where David Tashi of the San Francisco police was impersonating the Zodiac killer and writing letters to himself or to the city. And you had the SLA and the Zebra killings and the looking for Black people and practically having identification cards to be on the streets. And the Donald DeFries, Thera Wheeler escapades where they weren't looking for Wheeler, who had walked out of Vacaville and provided money for DeFries. Charles Gaines has been a bloodbath. I could see it coming the minute he was appointed in San Francisco. Why San Francisco would want him after he did such a bad job in Oakland, I really can't understand. San Francisco used to be a great city, and it combines all the elements of the Japanese community, the Italians, the Chinatown. The minorities there blended in, and the hippies and the blacks, and it was a very liberal, beautiful city. Just like our minds could be open and clear until the CIA came with their poisonous drugs and chemicals and began to alter people's personalities and turn them into violent zombies. So Gaines went to San Francisco, and it was in the San Francisco Police Department that Dan White had all of his buddies because he was a former policeman. And the entire trial, as I say, was for Dan White. Newspapers had articles this week that the jury was crying for Dan White for the moment they saw him. They played a tape about him, and they heard about his bravery and how normal he was and how he worked so well on his job and everybody loved him. And they actually physically cried for Dan White, even though he was one of the hardest stone-ass killers that they'll ever meet in their lifetime. These people's sympathy was with him because he had killed a homosexual and Moscone, the mayor, George Moscone, the mayor. Now, George Moscone was number one on the hit list of politicians to be murdered if Jim Jones died. We've talked about that before, but nobody in the district attorney's office would ask why, because Don Freitas, the district attorney, was linked to Jonestown. So nobody asked why. As I say, 16 members of the Jonestown community are represented by the CIA. 100 or 200 are still missing. 110 and 210, whichever figure, it's hard to tell which is accurate, but that many, minimum 110 are still missing. A boat is still missing. People that funded it and sent it up are missing. And the Congress and the State Department admit that killers are out at large, train killers are out at large, but nobody will look at Dan White and say that he is one of the train killers and that Moscone had to go or ask why. The San Francisco police wanted Moscone dead. They wanted Milk murdered. They represented the poor, the labor movement, the gays, the lesbians, Indians, blacks, minorities, you name it. And the people, the underdogs in the Bay Area felt comfortable with these two people, and they were both killed the same day. The psychiatrists that come in on these cases are the worst type of people. They remind me of the psychiatric studies of Nazi Germany, the bleeding hearts, and they say that Dan White was mentally sick for 23 years, one of them said. Dan White went to George Moscone. If he could have had the job back, if the answer was yes, White would have been normal the rest of his life, maybe. If he had said no, then Dan White was sick. But the point is that the yes and no, I don't think, really had anything to do with the reason George Moscone was murdered any more than the way William Sullivan smiles or Donald Donaldson talks or looks. I think they're murdered because they know too much. And the way that the case is run, the prosecution, it indicates that they absolutely don't want to get into anything political, and the district attorney stated that. Nobody's ever asked in this case about the money that Dan White had, about the cars, the Porsche, the Mercedes, the home, the furnishings, the trips to Ireland, several trips. Nobody would even think to look up his tax records, his income tax and his declared tax, to see if his spending exceeded his income. And if it did, who put up the difference? His wife was a teacher in Germany and Japan. I got a call from somebody this week that she also taught at a Philippines Army base, that somebody was with her in Germany and in the Philippines in the Army base, and that she could be trained in mind control, which was what I felt all along. She has the military connections, which put Dan White, by Lee Harvey Oswald, between Marina and Jean de Mornschild. He was between his aide, former aide, this Miss Afkar, and whose car he used to get away, and also his wife, who had the military experience. And, of course, there's no discussion of where he met her or when. Now, there's been other weak prosecutions. Some of them, I think, over the Watergate, the Maurice Stans, John Mitchell prosecution of the Security Exchange Commission, the money that was supposed to be transferred, the BESCO money, to these men for election campaigning. Both men got off, but what prosecutor in New York City is going to prosecute the former Secretary of the Treasury or the former Attorney General? And John Connally had a weak prosecution in the Milk Fund down in Texas, and his name was mentioned in stopping the patent and investigation of money to Watergate. John Connally and Gerald Ford were mentioned, but when their own co-workers and buddies are doing the prosecution, if they don't present hard evidence, then the jury can't do anything but acquit them, because the prosecution is weak. There was a jailer at the San Francisco jail by the name of James Denman. He wasn't called as a witness. He was with White after he turned himself in. He left and resigned from the jail recently because he couldn't get along with the administration there. It was criticizing it. He said White was receptive. He was got a reception not inconsistent with that of a hero when he went into the police department, that District Attorney Joe Freitas wouldn't use Denman as a trial witness, that the police and White were fraternal, that they smiled and gave him pats on the back, they were laughing and chummy, and that he was very purposeful and deliberate, and the court tried to show Dan White as a man of emotions who cried because of what he had done. And Denman says this isn't true at all. There was no shame, no guilt, no tears. He didn't show any emotion, and only one tear. He called his mother, "Hi, Mom, how are you doing? I guess you heard." And that was the only time he said he never noticed a quiver. He was businesslike. He was controlled. He was super cool after the murders. And his attitude against liberals and gays was open. He hated them, and it was never brought out the trial how much he disliked these people. Joe Freitas said he didn't want to deal with this. The district attorney decided that he didn't want to deal with political implications. Joe Freitas said he didn't want to call White's jailer, James Denman, because of, in quotes, political decisions. This was in the paper this week, and of course that confirms what I've been trying to say to you all along about what went on up there. This is another quotation. The prosecutor didn't want to go into the connection between police attitudes towards gays and liberals and Dan White's state of mind. Freitas called White's attitudes to his victims as irrelevant. That's like a case in the South where, remember, the Ku Klux Klan has a car and goes into a black man, runs over him, and murders him as he's crossing the street, where the car could have gone in another direction, and they can't bring out the fact that a black man was run down at night. They just say it was a car accident. The racism or the hatred has a lot to do with the state of mind of how you kill. This is true when people are in the Army and they get basic training. They're going to Vietnam. They were told about the kooks and the goons and how to hate and how to kill. And they would have to indoctrinate them with a certain amount of hatred to make them good killers. And the state of mind of Dan White about his victims, according to the district attorney, who also allowed these racist murders down in Vietnam to take place. So you know where D.A. Freitas is. These 913 murders, one quarter of them 16 years of age and younger. Who isn't investigating that, and who is not only not investigating it, but is a part of that racism and slavery and genocide and experimentation. He said it was irrelevant that the person that he's supposed to be prosecuting happened to hate the people that he killed. That wasn't important. Mr. Denman, the jailer, said there's a profound paranoia about gays in the police department and the prosecution, and D.A. Freitas didn't want to deal with this. I don't think he should exclude any subject if there is a motive for killing people that could be exploited by the police department. It should have been brought out. Now, Dan White didn't speak to Harvey Milk. He hated him. He hated him because there was a youth campus mental health facility in the neighborhood that Dan White had, and White was a racist. He didn't want blacks or poor brought into this area, and Milk voted that this particular former school or church be given to a youth campus mental health facility. So Dan White didn't speak to Harvey Milk. They had an intermediary that spoke to them. So when he went in to see him, Dianne Feinstein, a supervisor, said, come here and talk to me. He says, no, I want to talk with Harvey Milk. Why would he want to talk to him? He wouldn't talk to him at the Board of Supervisors. He walked in, and a minute and a half later, those fatal bullets, right to the head. He was blown away. They had an intense hatred. They had a difference with each other. They didn't have conversations. And yet the prosecution would make you believe that this was manslaughter, because when Dan White walked in, armed to the teeth and rearmed and loaded again after he killed one person, they want you to believe it was because Harvey Milk smirked at the time that Dan White committed manslaughter. It wasn't that he was bringing in mental health cases in the neighborhood, but Harvey Milk was responsible for his own murder because he smirked. We don't know if he smirked. He may have had the same face he always had. And Dan White hated him, so he killed him. And imagine this man may be on the streets. He could have probation and be out tomorrow. And worse than that, they want to send him to a federal prison, one of those Lompoc funny farms where he'll play golf with other hitmen and have a ball until he's out. And then they'll send him to Ireland, where he always wanted to be, and probably pay him off heavily with more fancy cars and say he suffered enough. There's more favoritism to follow. He can be on bail, according to the law. He could be on probation, according to the law. His two murders don't run consecutively. They run concurrently, which is a 7-year prison term, reduced to 2.5 to 3 years if they want. He could have mental testing and be out. So there's no reason for Dan White to even serve more time. It'll be up to the judge. Now, what did the San Francisco police do when all this was over? Dan White was one of their boys. Some of the jurors were associated with them. They might have known that there would be a reaction. J. Edgar Hoover knew that there would be a reaction when Martin Luther King was murdered, because he was the voice of moderation. Harvey Milk worked with the gay community. Moscone worked with the liberals in the area. And they knew there'd be some reaction. So in order to make sure it was great, jolly, good reaction, J. Edgar Hoover had provocateurs in Los Angeles, in Detroit, and in the South. And as soon as Martin Luther King was killed, instead of blacks going into deep mourning, certain blacks took to the streets and rioted, and later it turned out many were provocateurs. Well, the gay community got out on the streets. They had had a march after Harvey Milk had died. They got out on the streets and started walking to City Hall. And I think they know that the collusion and the crime was there. It was not down at the jail to lynch Dan White. This all was coming from City Hall. And they marched there, and the police were there. And the police stood there for 2.5 hours until they gathered. And some people started breaking the doors and the windows and burning cars and burning a computer set there. The damage, mildly, is $1 million damage. And the police watched for 2 hours, watched cars burned. They said they couldn't do anything, but they had tactical squads. They could do plenty. And they became the sympathetic ones. When things were hurled at them, they stood there. Now, Gaines has never been known for restraint. If he can get you, he gets you in the jugular. So in this case, they wanted the gays to be the violent ones and to make them look as if they're the rational ones at a time like this. So they stood there for 2.5 hours while stones and things were thrown at them, and didn't move, and let them beat up and break up and burn and pillage to show the violence of the gay community. And I'm sure they're assisted with provocateurs, and they're trying to check that out now. This built up for 2 hours so that the police officials are simply furious at Charles Gaines. The right wing is furious in that community because he didn't bring in help and didn't stop this damage. And the gay community is furious because he didn't stop in and use restraints. And not only was $1 million damaged, but the reputation to the gay community, just like the demonstrations in Los Angeles of the Iranians, made it appear that all Iranian students are off their rockers and not receptive to the rights of others in this country. Then, after that damage was done, the police department got their little cars. And again, this is Gaines' expertise. They went in with a vengeance, and they swept into the gay community like Nazi stormtroopers. They beat up, they tore apart, and it was just like the movie Cabaret or Serpent's Egg, and hell broke loose. And then the street theater began, and Charles Gaines' men began their bloody retaliation. Now, the police didn't come in and stop the group when they were meeting, but they went in to retaliate with personal vengeance, which they are not supposed to do any more than those policemen friends of Patty Hearst to go in and beat people up in a gay bar. And as I've said, I've quoted that book, California, the First Parafascist State, by Mr. Lamont. You have to realize that what goes on here, as I said at the beginning of tape, is what's going to happen in your own hometowns. This is a microcosm of this country, and it gets its breeding ground here, and then it spreads. This place is the window for tomorrow, described in that book. What they act out here, you will get tomorrow. The city hall was quiet by 11:30 at night. The gay community was quiet, and then the cops started coming. They went over to Castro Street, which is about 1 mile or 2 miles away. They went in marked cars. First there were 2 cars, then there were 3 cars, and then there were 3 people in the back seat, 3 in the front seat, and 1 cop leaned out and called a gay a name, a fag or something like that. That's fighting words. The fire engines came, and the crowds on the street watched because there weren't many people out there. They were in bars and off the streets, and they got out about 18th Street, and tax squad cars came, and there's a man named Inspector Webb who saw the police car coming into what was now quiet area and saying they're going to start a riot. Everything was quiet when they arrived, and then they said, "We lost City Hall. We aren't going to lose this one." As I say, the streets were quiet, and they selected a place called the Elephant Walk Bar, which is on Castro Street. They went in to get their revenge. These are people to protect the law. They had riot gear where the people they were to hit were unarmed. They had nightsticks, and for 10 minutes they duplicated the scenes out of the halls of Nazi Germany. They lost control. They crashed the bar stools. They broke chairs, windows, mowed everything down. One man was on TV last night, broken ribs, broken spleen, jaw cut. and there were about 20 riot police that swept through and broke everything in the place. One customer was sitting in the bar. He wasn't even at City Hall. He had nothing to do with this at all. They hit him on the head, the chin. They split open his chin. He has broken ribs. His lung has collapsed. He's in the hospital. Another man was hit with clubs across the head, stitches, and they were swinging and hurting. And then they walked out, and they took it upon themselves to beat up people that weren't even out of the building or on the street, who had nothing to do with the decisions. And they went in there, and in policeman's uniform, they started to beat these people up. Now, Dan White sat there like a robot during the trial. As I say, he was in a trance, and nobody bothered to ask why. Everybody talks about books such as War on the Mind, Operation Mind Control, another book on mind control, Battle for the Mind, The Control of Candy Jones. I could list 20 books on mind control. And there isn't one newspaper person, one author, one psychologist talking about Dan White being a zombie and being program killer. I think as far as of today, which is May 25th, 1979, I'm the only person that has said on radio and on tapes that he is a program killer. I called people in San Francisco today. They hadn't even thought about that he should be trained to murder. The prosecution in this case did not present evidence of premeditation, even though it was all there. Dan White was a robot. The manslaughter murder was done, according to them, in the heat of passion, which means that no murder anymore is murder. All are manslaughter because nobody is thinking about what they're doing. There's a murder trial today of a man who killed two people at the light company, Power and Light Company. And he said he was whipped by his parents and hit. And the psychologist representing him was the same psychologist at the trial of Dan White. And hardships as a child make you crack when you're older. And instead of killing himself, he killed two people. And the defense is that he snapped as an adult because of things that happened in his past. The family of George Moscone and Harvey Milk weren't brought into it. They wrote it off. We didn't have to bring in the family because he was gay. He had a brother. He has parents. He has cousins, people that care about him. We have families of friends that care. Not one of those people was considered. The jury was picked for their background, as I said, to law enforcement. None of them were challenged. They were all in Dan White's favor, and they justified these murders that they were in emotional turmoil, filled with a sense of rage, anger, and betrayal. With that justification, nobody is safe on the streets. Every murder is a justifiable homicide. This situation is the culmination of years of corruption in San Francisco, racism, getting away with murders, kidnappings, hiding the roots of the SLA, the Zodiac Killer. It is a terrible situation that won't be solved until they meet very basic questions on who funds these people, who provides the cars, the houses, the trips abroad, who puts up the money, what mental hospitals they've been in, where have their mates been. As soon as you answer those questions, you'll find out who is disarranging the natural political climate of this country. Whether it's the mayor, senators, candidates, supervisors, presidents, they're being killed because the police and the military want it. And the people are so dumb that even if the books come out and the information comes out that suggests that there's collusion or mind control, we sit here like a bunch of sheep and take it. And the only result of all this apathy has to be the escalation of bloodbath. Incidentally, with regards to Dan White, I am against the death penalty, and I believe that these zombies should be studied and deprogrammed, except that that's an inconsistency because the law enforcement has put them there in the first place, so they're not going to snitch on each other. There's a case of a man in California prisons now, Edmund Kemper, K-E-M-P-E-R, who was convicted of killing 8 people, one of them being his mother. And he was placed in California medical facilities. And there was a big lawsuit a few years back to have a lobotomy done on Kemper. They wanted to remove his brains. And a man named Hunter Brown, a psychosurgeon in California, who worked with Evel Younger and Dr. Jolly West, said that he did 300 behavioral operations. And Peter Bragan was against the psychosurgery, as I am, and believes that it shouldn't be done, but it's a good way to get rid of the brains of a person who snaps that the police department have used as a patsy. Once they're in jail, do the psychosurgery on them. Well, Hunter Brown wanted to do psychosurgery, and I saw Edmund Kemper on national television once, and he asked if he could have psychosurgery on his head, let Dr. Brown do that. This Kemper also had said at his trial that the policeman and a Navy man could have stopped him, that they saw him drag a body up to his apartment, and as much as hinted that he was assisted or with collusion, that people knew what he was doing and weren't stopping him, and he became a mass murderer. As a child, he had murdered his grandparents when he was 15 years old, so he's really a good subject to work with. So they kept him in a mental hospital and then let him out and to work on the streets. He was in the Santa Cruz area, and the court denied him permission to have psychosurgery. He wanted that to alter his brain and let Hunter Brown, who worked with the CIA, do that to him. He was at Atascadero for 5.5 years, and then he was sent out. Well, now Edmund Kemper just got a trophy this last April, in Vacaville Medical Facilities. He's contributed 2,900 hours to making tape recordings of books for the blind, and now they admit that he has an IQ of 130, that he is intelligent, and that he's made 1.75 million feet of tape. He reads 28 hours a week, and he's produced 1.75 million feet of tape, and this program uses volunteer inmates from the California medical facilities. So they've taken this mind that wanted a lobotomy, that probably couldn't reason or think or remember afterwards, wanted to do psychosurgery on him, and people like Dr. Peter Bragan were instrumental in stopping it. And I'd written letters and really objected. I objected to this totally, of mutilating the brain with a needle or a knife. And now he's a very useful member of society. I have a friend who's blind, and she may be receiving books that Edmund Kemper is reading, and they're tape recording books on the tape cassettes, and there's a large library for the blind, so that people that have committed crimes can be very useful for society and feel that their life is useful and do something. You can't make it up to the people he killed. But the point is that at the time of his trial, he was supposed to have a low IQ, a person that could be having his head mutilated, and he asked for it on television. And when they stepped in and said, no, this is wrong, he diverted his life to something useful, and that's the way it should be. And Dr. Brown had already bragged about doing 300. We saw one of his 300 on television, and it was a blubbering idiot, a really sick person who couldn't function anymore after the surgery was done. But that's one way of getting rid of political patsies, using them for particular political services of the police department and law enforcement, and then mutilate their brains and just leave them going on like a vegetable garden later. I'm glad to see that Kemper is able to do this work. I'm sure he feels good about it. And as I say, last month he got a trophy for the amount of time that he's put into reading books so the blind can hear these books. I want to give you, on the printed sheet that goes with the tape, the address of a group called Campaign for Political Rights. They had a convention this last December. The purpose is to end covert operation and spying and harassment abroad and overseas. And if you send them some money, they have a 15-page booklet with endless addresses of all kinds of movements and sources of documentation in the Senate and important information you have on covert action, Freedom of Information Act, Grand Jury Project, the Michigan Coalition to End Government Spying. They have a list of 30 or 40 organizations and cassette recordings. My tapes are listed here along with other tapes on Red Squads on campus, inside the CIA, videotape cassettes, the murder of Fred Hampton, Punishment Park, the Rockford Files, slideshows, posters, and films that are available, and articles, newsletters, the addresses of where to get the newsletters, and a complete list of people trying to stop, I don't know how much good we're doing, the counterintelligence activity. They have literature on surveillance of women, spying on nuclear power opponents, the surveillance of black Americans, terrorism, and political surveillance, local and state police spying, harassment. There are addresses, oh, maybe there's 200-300 addresses to write for on CIA and mind control, human drug testing, reports by the U.S. Senate committee, hearings, and a book on the mind manipulators, memoirs of former employees. It's broken down into all kinds of subjects on repression, intelligence community, and so forth. It's silly for me to spend a whole tape on this. I'm sure that for a dollar you can buy all the names of the organizations and the addresses and see how much information is available. So I'm going to pass that along to you and let you send for that material, because I think it will interest a lot of you in particular areas that you're interested in. A lot of information here. Keep you busy for years to come if you can absorb all of it. And one last item, fast, because we don't have much time. I did two tapes in January on John Paisley, the CIA official who was reported to have committed suicide by the Pentagon and the CIA and the FBI. Two life insurance companies this week refused to pay benefits to his widow because they said they believe he's alive and that the body that was identified as John Paisley is not his. He has been missing, and they claim that they can't pay because they don't believe that he's dead. Our time is out again. I'll see you next week. Take care of yourselves, and we have a pile of news to share. The week goes fast, and I'll be back with you next week. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California.